Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, hello there and welcome along. It's Justin Brierley here with your weekly dose of apologetics and theology from Unbelievable. But a bit of a change to the planned show this week. We were due to bring you a debate on abortion law. Well, that'll actually come your way next week. Instead, today's show marks the launch of Confident Christianity, something we've been lining up for a little while now, our brand new online apologetics course from Unbelievable and Premier, aimed at helping you understand the evidence for God and answer objections to faith. So I thought, why not make a big deal of this on this week's Unbelievable show? On today's show, I'm going to be playing out some audio from the videos that we're using as part of this course to deliver this online training. We're hosting the course on the Udemy learning platform, but for a 50% discount on the course to celebrate the launch, you can go to our webpage, premier.org.uk/get confident, and you'll find that link with today's show on podcast as well. It's good for the first 5 days of October, so do act now if you want to get the course at a 50% discount. That's at premier.org.uk/get confident. So yeah, I'm so pleased to be bringing you the launch of the Confident Christianity online apologetics course. I've been hosting this Unbelievable radio show and podcast for over 15 years now, believe it or not, and in that time I've sat down with literally hundreds of Christians and non-Christians to debate the evidence for faith. Now, after all those years of engaging atheists, agnostics, and skeptics, I actually remain more confident than ever that Christianity is an intellectually robust option for thinking people. That's why, along with myself, in this course, you'll learn from some of the world's leading Christian thinkers, people like William Lane Craig, Professor John Lennox, Amy Orr Ewing, and Gary Habermas, and all of the evidence that they've presented for Christianity at past Unbelievable conferences. So the way we structure this course, and we'll be getting to some audio from one of the sessions in just a moment, is by creating 6 modules, helping you think through questions around the evidence for Christianity versus atheism, philosophical arguments for God, the problem of suffering, science and faith, and the evidence for the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. So if you're anything like me, you know that we live in an increasingly secular and skeptical world, can often feel like faith is under threat. But I do believe that faith isn't simply blind belief. You know, it's actually trusting in something we've got good evidence for. And I think that in recent years, Christianity has actually undergone a revival of its intellectual tradition. And there's a new generation of believers emerging who are equipped to engage the world with all of their hearts, their soul and their mind. So as you're listening, wherever you are on the faith journey, I hope that this course might help to bring you that confidence to take the message of the risen Jesus to many more. So we're going to be hearing some excerpts from the video material from the course across the course of today's show. And again, just a reminder, you can get the course at 50% off in the first 5 days of October. That's premier.org.uk/get confident. And again, that link is with today's podcast, if that's how you're listening. Well, shall we jump in? The questions and learning activities for each module in this course are based around a key training video. And it all begins with me making the case for Christianity versus atheism by talking about what it's been like to be hosting this show for so many years. Let's hear some of it. I've recently adopted a new strap line for the show that I often introduce the programme with. Conversations that matter. Conversations are really important, aren't they? When I started at Premier Christian Radio, my broadcasting career, I began on The Breakfast Show. In fact, I've got a slide here, and this will show you how much I've aged in the time. It's the next one on, guys. There you go. I look about 12, don't I, in that picture? But these were my co-host. I was the co-host with John Pantry, the man in the middle, and Maria for The Breakfast Show. And that really taught me the ropes of radio and how to get a conversation going. In many ways, one of the key things that I did was try to stimulate the conversation when it came to the daily phone-in. And I soon learned that one of the fastest ways to spark a listener reaction was to have some kind of a voice, a controversial voice, even if it was my own, playing devil's advocate on the radio that they would respond to. And soon enough, I was given the opportunity to create a radio show for myself from scratch, a weekly spot in the schedule that I could call my very own. Now, Premier Christian Radio was already very good at a specific kind of broadcasting. We were good at creating conversations between Christians. Christians talking about Christian things to other Christians, all important and helpful. But I wanted to widen the conversation a bit. The fact is, less than 5% of people in the UK attend church on a Sunday. So what about reaching that vast, untapped, non-Christian audience that was out there? What about reaching beyond our own bubble? So the format of this new show was fairly simple. I'd sit down with two guests each week, one a Christian and the other not, to talk to them about why one believed and the other didn't. And we'd take calls from listeners and see what they had to say, and we'd title the show Unbelievable with a question mark. And in 11 and a half years now, not that much has actually changed, except that we ended up not taking listener calls in the end, and we leave the feedback to the end of the show. But the question mark on the end of Unbelievable was essential. Each show would debate some kind of a question with the intention of testing the central claims of Christianity. Could they stand up to scrutiny? What were the alternative views? And along the way, what could we learn from each other, other people outside the Christian faith who could join in the big conversation? So it was on Saturday afternoon in late November 2005 that the very first episode of Unbelievable aired. Now, the picture you're about to see is not from that episode. That was not one that I had a camera handy for. But this is a typical sort of setup in the studio, two guests joining me to talk about the show across the desk. And the very first guests I actually had, and one of them's actually here at the conference, I'm glad to say, were a priest called John Twistleton, Father John Twistleton, and his non-believing neighbour, Clive. Not superstars of the Christian and atheist world, but nonetheless, two people who joined me to have a frank conversation about their belief or disbelief. And that's where it all began, and really, the conversation has continued ever since, and it would lead to many years of learning from each other, and the calls did come flooding in. Now, I became a Christian around the age of 15. Everyone has a different story, but mine was a powerful experience of God at a youth retreat. And I'll be forever grateful for the youth pastor and the people who mentored me in my early faith. And when I experienced the presence of Jesus in my life, I immediately wanted to go out and tell other people about him. But as we all know, it's not always that simple. A lot of the reaction I got from my school friends, I was doing A-levels at the time, was, well, that's great for you, Justin, but... And the fact was, I had had a very personal, very powerful experience, but it was hard for me to convey that to others who simply didn't know about that experience. Now, for some people, simply telling them your testimony, how God's changed your life, is enough to spark enough curiosity to make them investigate the claims of Christianity for themselves. But often people need something else. They need people who are very skeptical are perhaps looking for reasons that are available to both of us. Objective reasons rather than our personal subjective reasons to consider the claims of Christianity, something we've both got access to. And that's when we come to the technical word, apologetics. Now, if you'd said apologetics to me when I began Unbelievable, I would probably have thought you were apologizing for something, saying sorry. I really wasn't familiar with the term when I began the show, but I soon did get familiar with the term because essentially apologetics, the defense of the faith, is what the show has been about for many years.
It's what Paul was doing in Athens when he spoke at the Areopagus to the Greek philosophers and put the claims of Christ to them. And it's what we're advised to do in 1 Peter 3:15. Bring that up on the screen. Well-known verse, and really it's become the central verse of the show. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have, but do this with gentleness and respect. And that's what we aimed to do on the show, give a reason for the hope that we have, but to do it with civility, with gentleness, with respect.
You're listening to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. Today's show, a little bit different to usual, bringing you highlights from our brand spanking new online apologetics course, Confident Christianity, Evidence for God, Answering Objections. And you can watch the rest of that talk you heard the start of by me on Christianity and atheism at the course, along with all the questions and learning activities that accompany it. So there are over 4 hours of video teaching from a range of brilliant Christian thinkers who have joined us at the Unbelievable Conference over past years. Again, the course available now, 50% off if you get hold of it before the end of the 5th of October, premier.org.uk/get confident. Now, we heard from him in this week's Classic Replay, actually, and he returns this week as part of the lineup on this course, Professor William Lane Craig, and bringing us 7 philosophical arguments for the existence of God. But here's how he began his talk.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and thank you for coming out on a Saturday to spend it engaging your minds with these important questions. Jan and I are just delighted to be with you today. We always enjoy being back in the mother country, and so it's a thrill for us to be here and participating in this conference. And I've been invited to talk today about, is there evidence for God? It's a truism that British society is post-Christian. The British social historian Callum Brown argues that the death of Christian Britain occurred during a remarkably brief period of time between about 1960 and 1975. Unbelief was symptomatic of the 1960s. On April 8, 1966, the American newsweekly Time carried a lead story for which the cover was completely black, except for 3 words emblazoned in bright red letters against the dark background. And the words read, "Is God dead?" And the story described the so-called death of God movement then current in American theology. The philosophical precedents for faith's demise during the 1960s were laid in the previous decades. Back in the 1940s and 50s, it was widely believed among philosophers that talk about God is meaningless because it's not verifiable by the 5 senses. The book Language, Truth, and Logic by the British philosopher A.J. Ayer served as a sort of manifesto of this movement. The principal weapon used by Ayer in his crusade against anything metaphysical was the vaunted verification principle of meaning. According to that principle, a sentence, in order to be meaningful, must be capable, in principle, of being empirically verified. Since metaphysical statements were beyond the reach of empirical science, they could not be verified and were therefore dismissed as meaningless. Now, Ayer was very explicit about the theological implications of this verificationism. Since God is a metaphysical object, the possibility of knowledge was, and I quote, ruled out by our treatment of metaphysics. Thus, there can be no knowledge of God. The collapse of this verificationism during the second half of the 20th century was undoubtedly the most important philosophical event of the century. philosophers discovered that the verification principle was not only unscientific, but in fact self-refuting. The statement, "You should only believe what can be scientifically proven," cannot itself be scientifically proven. The downfall of verificationism prompted a resurgence of metaphysics, along with other traditional problems of philosophy, which had been suppressed by verificationism. And accompanying this resurgence came something new and altogether unanticipated, a renaissance of Christian philosophy. Ironically, this renaissance began at the same time that the theologians of the 1960s were writing God's obituary and Christian Britain was dying. The seminal event probably came in 1967 with the publication of Alvin Plantinga's book, God and Other Minds, which applied the tools of analytic philosophy to problems in the philosophy of religion with an unprecedented rigor and care. And in his train has followed a host of Christian philosophers, writing in the professional journals and participating in professional conferences and publishing with the finest academic presses. And the face of Anglo-American philosophy has been transformed as a result. Atheism, though still the dominant position at the university, is today a philosophy in retreat. In a recent article, the University of Western Michigan philosopher Quentin Smith laments what he calls the desecularization of academia that evolved in philosophy departments since the late 1960s, complaining of naturalists' passivity in the face of the wave of intelligent and talented theists entering academia today. Smith concludes, God is not dead in academia. He returned to life in the late 1960s and is now alive and well in his last academic stronghold, philosophy departments. The renaissance of Christian philosophy has been accompanied by a resurgence of interest in natural theology, which is that branch of theology that seeks to defend the existence of God apart from the resources of divine authoritative revelation. All of the traditional arguments for God's existence, including the cosmological, teleological, moral, ontological arguments, not to mention creative new arguments, find intelligent and articulate defenders on the contemporary intellectual scene. But you may ask, what about the new atheism exemplified by people like Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, and A.C. Grayling, and so forth? Doesn't it herald a reversal of this trend? Not really. As is evident from their bibliographies, the new atheism is, in fact, a pop cultural movement, lacking in intellectual muscle and blissfully ignorant of the revolution that has taken place in Anglo-American philosophy. I am frankly astonished at the degree to which the lingering shadow of a long-dead verificationism still hangs over much of popular culture. It comes to expression especially in the popular works of scientists like Stephen Hawking, Lawrence Krauss, and Richard Dawkins, who have no firsthand acquaintance with and nothing but disdain for philosophy. The new atheism is a vestige of the verificationism of a bygone generation and is remarkably out of touch with the contemporary intellectual scene. The revival of natural theology in our day is a great boon to the church. In talking to people, I find that the most commonly repeated objection to belief in God is there's no evidence for God's existence. Since most Christians are ill-equipped to defend their belief in God, this serves as an effective conversation stopper. But if you've mastered a few arguments for God's existence, then that objection won't stump you. If the unbeliever says there's no evidence for God's existence, you should look at him in astonishment and say, "Is that what you think? Well, I can think of at least 5 good reasons to believe that God exists." And at that point, he's got to say, "Yeah, like what?" And then you're off and running. What was meant to be a conversation stopper has suddenly become a conversation starter. And what you'll discover, I predict, is that most unbelievers are almost completely uninformed concerning arguments for God's existence. They've just learned to repeat the slogan, "There's no evidence for God's existence," and they have little to say beyond that.
I tell you, you'll be drinking from a fire hose when you watch the full video of William Lane Craig doing 7 philosophical arguments for the existence of God in that seminar. That's all available, of course, when you get hold of our Confident Christianity course. This is Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley, introducing you this week to our brand new online apologetics course, a sneak peek at some of the video teaching on there. And you can go online now to see the video promo at the show page today or on our social media, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. But let's hear from another longtime friend of the show, Professor John Lennox, whose talk on science and faith is featured as part of the course. Here's an intro to his talk.
There is a sense in which the new atheists are a bit passé. They've been replaced by the new atheists, which are the old atheists. The aggressiveness of Dawkins and so on is resented by many people today, and they don't have anything like the traction. But I guess why we're looking at this is because of the huge influence they've had, particularly on the younger generation. I constantly, when visiting schools particularly, addressed by chaplains who say, "Why is everybody a Dawkins person?" And that just shows that books like The God Delusion and so on have had enormous traction. Now, Dawkins is not simply an atheist, he is anti-God, and militantly so. "I am attacking God, all gods, anything and everything supernatural, wherever and whenever they have been or will be invented." And you notice the assumption behind this statement. Stephen Hawking, of course, the far better scientist, has recently added his name publicly to the list of atheists. A Brief History of Time left it open because he wrote on the last page why it is that we in the universe exist. If we find the answer to that, it would be the ultimate triumph of human reason, for then we would know the mind of God. But much more recently, he explained what he meant by that. What I meant by we would know the mind of God is we would know everything that God would know if there was a God, which there isn't. I'm an atheist. So that's explicit. Before we understand science, it is natural to believe that God created the universe. But now science offers a more convincing explanation. That statement is important because it helps us understand what's going on in the culture. It's God as explanation pitted against science as explanation. And I want to demonstrate that that's a completely false formulation to start with and very misleading. But this idea of science offering explanations has reached its zenith in the philosophy that we call scientism. And scientism, expressed by Sir Harry Kroto, who won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry, regards science as the only way to truth. Science is the only philosophical construct we have to determine truth with any degree of reliability. This idea that there's only one way to truth, of course, it's nonsense, even from a logical perspective. That statement is a statement by a scientist. It is not a statement of science. So therefore, he didn't get it from science. So if he's right, he's wrong. And perhaps it's too early in the day for logic, but these extreme statements often are self-refuting before you start. It is a logically contradictory statement. Now, another Nobel Prize winner who was much wiser was Erwin Schrödinger, one of the scientists who developed quantum mechanics. "I am very astonished," he wrote, "that the scientific picture of the real world around me is very deficient. It gives a lot of factual information, puts all our experience in a magnificently consistent order, but it is ghastly silent about all and sundry that is really near to our heart, that really matters to us. It cannot tell us a word about red and blue, bitter and sweet, physical pain and physical delight. It knows nothing of beautiful and ugly, good or bad, God and eternity. Science sometimes pretends to answer questions in these domains, but the answers are very often so silly that we are not inclined to take them seriously." I'm passionate about science, but we don't help ourselves if we think that science is in the unique position of leading to truth. If that were true, by the way, we'd have to shut at least half the faculties in every university tomorrow. You'd have no more history, literature, economics, and music, and art, and so on. Here's another Nobel Prize winner for science, E.T.S. Walton. I hope you've heard of him. He's the only Irishman ever to have won the Nobel Prize for science. And he was a believer. He, by the way, split the atom with Sir John Cockcroft, so his eminence is unquestioned. One way to learn the mind of the Creator is to study His creation. We must pay God the compliment of studying His work of art. And this should apply to all realms of human thought. A refusal to use our intelligence honestly is an act of contempt for Him who gave us that intelligence. And here's a completely different way of looking at science as a study of the works of God, and paying Him a compliment, or as we might put it today, worshiping Him. And you get eminent scientists who agree with that. Sir Gillian France was the head of Kew Gardens for a long time. For many years he wrote, "I have believed that God is the great designer behind all nature. I made a commitment to Christ as my personal savior while a student at Oxford University. All my studies in science since then have confirmed my faith. I regard the Bible as my principal source of authority." So what we've seen so far is the obvious. There are eminent scientists who are atheists, and there are eminent scientists who are not only theists but Christians. What does that tell us? It tells us that the issue is not science versus God. And if we might illustrate it by taking Walton with Peter Higgs, who won the Nobel Prize for Physics quite recently in Edinburgh, those two men have won the top prize in physics. So what separates them is not their physics, that's obvious. What separates them is their worldview. Higgs is an atheist, Walton a Christian. And I want to suggest that if we're ever going to understand what's going on in our culture today, we need to realize that the real conflict is not between science and theology, but between worldviews. The worldview of naturalism and the worldview of theism. Naturalism is the flip side of atheism. Atheists often claim they don't believe anything. They just believe there's no God. That is not true. Otherwise, Dawkins wouldn't have written a 400-page book on the God delusion. Because their atheism has a correlative, and that is naturalism. All that follows from denying the existence of God. It is a worldview. It is a belief system. Every bit as much as Christianity, except there's evidence for Christianity. I'm not convinced there's evidence for the atheist belief system. So what we're faced with in the culture, two main worldviews. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and he maintains it. And Carl Sagan, cosmos is all there is or was or ever shall be. The one is Christian theism, the other is naturalism. It's actually materialism. And you know, one of my intellectual heroes is Socrates. And even way back then, about 300 BC, he raised this question. Whether all this which they call the universe is left to the guidance of unreason and chance medley, or, on the contrary, as our fathers have declared, ordered and governed by a marvelous intelligence and wisdom. And Socrates' question goes right to the heart of the culture. So we can rephrase what we've just said. What is the real relationship between science and worldview? Because Dawkins uses science, particularly biology, to push for atheism. Is that a valid thing to do? Or does science point more towards theism? And just to make it stark, we'll see that sometimes the worldview precedes the science, but isn't deduced from it. Here's a classic example, another Nobel Prize winner, George Klein. I am not an agnostic. I am an atheist. My attitude is not based on science, but rather on faith. Notice that, please. He believes it. The absence of a creator, the non-existence of God, is my childhood faith, my adult belief, unshakable and holy. That's prior to his science. He's not deducing it from science at all. It's something that he has in his basic worldview.
That was Professor John Lennox, and you can watch his talk in full as part of the video teaching at Confident Christianity. It's our brand new online apologetics course, and you can get 50% off it right now through to the 5th of October when you register over at premier.org.uk/get confident. We're listening to a special edition of Unbelievable this week, profiling some of the material on this brand new course that we're launching this October. We'll be back shortly.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome back to the second part of this week's edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. What we normally do on this show is bring you all kinds of interesting ethical, Christian, philosophical, biblical debates between Christians and non-Christians. Today, though, making space for some of the material from our Confident Christianity course, which we've just released online. It's the very first online apologetics course we've ever published from Unbelievable, so I'm really excited about that. As you will have heard on the show today, we've got a 50% listener discount just for the first 5 days of October. Do make use of that if you can by enrolling on the course at premier.org.uk/get confident. Well, along with myself in this course, you'll learn from some of the world's leading Christian thinkers, William Lane Craig, John Lennox, Amy Orr Ewing, and Gary Habermas. And why don't we leap back in and hear a little of Amy Orr Ewing's talk on why God would allow suffering.
We have a huge question before us, the question of pain and suffering in the world. And I'm going to be bringing in insights from C.S. Lewis as we go through the session. We're going to try and leave a good 15 minutes for questions at the end. Pray for me that that will be possible. I suppose I want to start by saying it's always important in apologetics to remember that the questions that people ask us don't occur within a vacuum of abstract thought. And particularly this question, suffering doesn't happen in some neutral vacuum where we're all completely unaffected by the question. So suffering doesn't happen in an abstract vacuum of philosophizing. And just, you know, this week, my godmother died. I was at her funeral this week. We've seen a British serviceman beheaded on the streets of London. My dear friend in church, who's only just become a Christian, within 3 weeks of becoming a Christian, discovered she has breast cancer. She's got two children. One of my best friends in the whole world, who I was her bridesmaid, her husband has a brain tumour, and humanly speaking, things are not looking good for him. A member of my church in the last few months has lost her five-week-old baby. We've buried him. So I stand here this afternoon to say that as we talk about suffering, and we are going to talk about it from an intellectual perspective today, but as we do that, I want you to bear in mind that reality that we all face, and that's just me, and every single one of us in this room will be bringing experiences to the table today. So pain is real in the experience of real people, and any answer that does not connect with that reality is not an answer. In apologetics, we have to be careful about rushing in with intellectual arguments. We can win arguments and lose people, and Jesus is just not interested in that. He's not interested in us being intellectually superior. So I just wanted to begin by saying that, really. But then to say that, having said all of that, the reality is that for many people, the question of suffering in a more abstract sense, how can there be all this evil and suffering in the world, is a real objection to Christian faith. If there was a loving God who really cared about people and who was powerful, genuinely omnipotent, you know, surely we wouldn't have the world we're in, and that must disprove that there is this loving, all-powerful God. C.S. Lewis in 1940 set out to write an intellectual response to the question of suffering. I was rereading it this week, and I noticed how impersonal what he writes is in The Problem of Pain compared to his other books, A Grief Observed, where he writes very personally about his own experience of losing his wife. So in Lewis the Apologist, we have both a response to the intellectual question and a personal response to the issue of suffering. And if you are a book giver, if you're someone who gives out books to other people, I think A Grief Observed is probably one of the best books you can give someone who's lost somebody recently, because it's a very deep look at this question. So let's think about how we're going to do this today. We're going to look at this question of God and suffering from a variety of different perspectives. We're going to look at the comparative answers that are out there to what sense we can make of suffering, and see the Christian answer in context with other answers. And we're going to draw on C.S. Lewis a little bit. We're going to then think about, if we have time, the question of natural disasters. How do we answer that question? And the question of karma. You know, do people just get what they deserve? If something bad happens, has that person merited that? And we're going to bring it all down to land. I hope that sounds okay. So let's look at this question together then. Beginning, having said what I've said about the practical reality of suffering in our lives and the necessity for us as Christians of being able to make an emotional response with people who suffer that is appropriate, which doesn't involve rushing in with philosophical answers, but involves being there, listening to people, praying with them, inviting God by his Holy Spirit to come and be present with us in suffering. Having said all of that, let's now look at the question from a more intellectual perspective. So there's no question that this issue of human suffering is deeply baffling. There is no question that when posited in the way I said earlier by the atheist, you know, if there was a loving God, and he was all powerful, and he's also good, we wouldn't have the world that we're in. In other words, the argument is either God isn't actually loving because there's all this suffering and he can't really genuinely love people, and because he's powerful and he could step in. So he's either loving, or he's either loving but not powerful enough to step in and save us, or he's really, really powerful but he's not loving because he doesn't step in to stop suffering. Do you see the dilemma? That's how it's posed. And this is presented as a proof that God must not exist. He can't exist. It's been used by philosophers over years, and it packs a punch, this one. It packs a punch. It puts us on the back foot as Christians, and some of us may feel that right now.
You're listening to Unbelievable, today's show, different to usual, bringing you highlights from our brand spanking new online apologetics course. It's called Confident Christianity, Evidence for God, Answering Objections. And you can watch the rest of that talk by Amy Orr Ewing on suffering as part of the course, along with all the questions and learning activities that accompany it. So there are over 4 hours of video teaching from loads more brilliant Christian thinkers like Amy who have joined us at Unbelievable, the conference, over the years. And again, a 50% listener discount till the 5th of October, premier.org.uk/getconfident to register. The link is with today's podcast if that's how you're listening. Let's leap into another talk from the course by Amy, whose talk on the evidence for Jesus is a core part of one of the modules on looking at the evidence for the life and history of Jesus. Let's hear some of that now.
So on the one hand, in our world, there are people who will risk everything and pay a very high cost in order to be able to read the Bible. And yet at the same time in our world, there are many people who deride the Bible, who say, well, you can't trust it. You know, it's filled with fairy tales. It's been made up. Jesus was just a legend, or somehow this was an agenda, a patriarchal conspiracy of a group of men who tried to propagate a myth that isn't true and to take power over other people's lives through pushing their own agenda. Or there would be people in some of the great universities of our country, and I experienced this as a student studying theology, who would look at you as an evangelical Christian, someone who believes the Bible, look at you with real pity. You know, poor you. You are so naive as to actually believe in this book. Maybe after 3 years at a great university, we'll cure you of your naivety. So in this session together, we're going to be looking at how we begin to answer that sort of skepticism. Can we trust the biblical account? And we're going to really look at that in two sections. We're going to look at the question of, can we trust the text? We're going to look at the issue of textual criticism. And then we're going to look at the question of, can we trust the actual content, and specifically about Jesus? So we're going to be looking at the Gospels. Is there any reason for us to actually believe that what these Gospels say about Jesus is true rather than legendary? So let's begin with this question. Can we really trust the text? Well, of course, you know that the Bible is a compilation of 66 books, 39 in the Old Testament, 27 in the New. The Bible is written over a period of 1,600 years by more than 40 authors. And they were people from all kinds of different backgrounds: kings, diplomats, poor people, fishermen, tent makers. The Bible is written in three languages: Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek. And it's written on three continents: Asia, Africa, and Europe. Already we can see that this is not a white man's religion. Already we can see that there is no conspiracy of one particular kind of person, one particular kind of language, or one particular geography. The vast multiplicity of the Bible cultures that produce the text of the Bible, from which the text comes, is then multiplied as the Bible is copied and reproduced and translated into other languages. So particularly with the New Testament, when we're talking about the text or the manuscripts that we're dealing with, we're talking about thousands of manuscripts that survive in multiple different languages. But of course, the New Testament was written in Greek, and so we're going to focus on that this morning since time is short. We have around 5,800 handwritten manuscripts in the Greek language supporting the New Testament. Now, people will say, well, how can we trust it? Hasn't it been corrupted? Aren't there all of these variations and differences between the texts? And this is the point at which the study of textual criticism comes in. Textual criticism is simply the discipline that helps us to determine the original wording of any document whose original no longer exists. Okay, so textual criticism can be applied to any book, the Quran or the Bible or Caesar's Gallic War or Plato, or, you know, it's not just about the Bible, it's about any document whose original doesn't exist anymore. Now, when you pursue this discipline of textual criticism, what you do is you gather the available manuscripts that do exist and you examine them and you compare them with one another. As I've already said, over 5,800 Greek manuscripts of the New Testament have been catalogued. And what we see when we examine these manuscripts is that overall, what we see is a huge amount of overlap, but there is some variation. There is some variation. There are what we call textual variants. One precise form of the text has not been preserved. Michael Nasir Ali writes this: "The survival of variant manuscripts is regarded as a strength by Christian scholars in establishing a critical text of the New Testament. The variations do not appear to have compromised either the historical integrity of the New Testament or its reliability as a canon of Christian doctrine in any substantive way. The existence of a large number of manuscripts in different ancient languages with their origins in widely separated churches, yet in substantial agreement with each other, is an argument in favour of the New Testament." Now, I don't know if you ever read the Bible and you see a little letter A next to a verse and it will say, you know, in some manuscripts, this word is in the plural or this word isn't in there. Why do our translations of the Bible do that? Because there is no conspiracy to cover up the reality that the Bible is an ancient manuscript. And there are multiple manuscripts upon which it is based, and that is a strength. If only one copy survived, which had been pushed through by the church, that would reek of conspiracy, that would reek of power play. So the goal of textual criticism is to establish the original text with as much precision as possible. And as we look at this with regard to the New Testament, with the Bible, what we see is quite amazing, I think. What we see is an astonishing integrity of the message of the text. Now, even some of the most radical liberal scholars like Bart Ehrman, who works in America today, who works in this whole area of textual criticism, will agree that no substantive historical fact about Jesus or important Christian doctrine is questioned by the variations that we see within the textual criticism movement. So let's think for a moment about what some of the earliest fragments are. And this is important. If you were to say to me, what's the earliest piece of the New Testament that exists? 10 years ago, someone might have said, well, it's called the John Ryland Papyrus, and it's kept in the University of Manchester Library. And it's a piece of John's Gospel from John chapter 18, verses 31 to 33 on one side, and John 18, 37 to 38 on the other side. It's a double-sided papyrus. Another scholar might say, well, actually, the earliest thing we've got is a fragment of Matthew's Gospel, which is kept in Magdalen College Library. And one scholar argues that that's from the first century, others saying it's from the early second century. But just last year, in 2012, on February the 1st, a scholar called Dan Wallace was debating with Bart Ehrman, who I talked to you about, and that they were debating about the integrity of the New Testament. And he announced that six more second century papyri, that means pieces of the New Testament from after 100 AD, but that six of them have been found, and that one of them, a fragment of Mark's Gospel, has a good case for having been written in the first century, certainly within the lifetime of the disciples. Now, he's planning to publish this book this year, and it needs to be peer-reviewed by scholars. But this is a staggering find in a collection in Turkey that had just been held by somebody and people didn't know what was in it. It contains a fragment from Luke's Gospel and probably the earliest piece of Mark's Gospel that we have. Why is this important? It's important that we have pieces of the New Testament that are so early, because it doesn't leave enough time for legend to accumulate.
You're listening to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, introducing this week our brand new online apologetics course with a sneak peek at some of the video teaching there, or at least the audio of the video teaching here on the podcast. You can go online to see the video promo over at our show page or via our social media. And the final module of this new course from Unbelievable is based around a talk by Gary Habermas on the evidence for the resurrection. So here's Gary, who's a well-known scholar of the New Testament and resurrection studies, introducing the subject.
Hopefully my doing this timeline is going to keep everybody on task and you'll be following together with me. So I'm going to go down here. And I'm going to start right here. This is ground zero, 30-ish AD, the cross. That's creation. That's 2016, way down there. But we're only going to be doing, for the most part, we're only going to be marching off a 25-year period here. Okay? But I'm going to call this ground zero because, like I said, could be 30, could be 33. But this is close enough, and I say ground zero because we're interested in how far are we down the road from this date, because we're doing history. The same way you do history if your PhD in ancient history was on Richard the Lionheart, and you want early sources for Richard. That's how you do history. And the 1-2 punch in history are the two E's, early and eyewitness. Now, people will say, well, you know, eyewitnesses aren't always right. Of course they aren't. Then why do you think they're used so much? Well, I don't know. Ask the historians. But why do you think eyewitnesses are used so much if they're not always trustworthy? Okay, I'll tell you what. Why don't you do your dissertation on Richard the Lionhearted and use, instead of using early eyewitness sources, why don't you use late, nobody knew him sources? Just because eyewitnesses can be wrong once in a while, do you think you should use non-eyewitnesses from 600-700 years later? Would that make you happy? Oh, no, I want to use the early ones. There you go. So in history, earlier is better, eyewitness is better. And we want to talk about how do we get back to ground zero. All right, so if we're going to do the book of 1 Corinthians, I'll put 1 Corinthians about here at 55 AD or plus 25, because that's ground zero. We're going plus and minus. Well, there's no minus in this lecture, but plus. We're at plus 25 right here, right? 55 AD. Now, there's two major ways you can argue for the historicity of the resurrection. The first way that most New Testament scholars use is to use the Gospels. I don't think it's anywhere near as strong an argument as the one I'm going to use. When you see me start going to this side, I'm doing the second argument. But for right now, let me outline the gospel argument, because it's good. It's still useful. In fact, James Crossley, the agnostic friend of mine who I was talking about dialoguing with, he did his doctoral dissertation on the Gospel of Mark. Guess when most scholars date Mark? Somebody want to give me a year, real loud? A date for the Gospel of Mark? 60, 70 at the most, 75. That's where scholars put Mark. James Crossley puts Mark at about 40 A.D. He's an agnostic, but he would put Mark, if that's ground zero, he puts Mark about here, 40 A.D. You can't write your dissertation on that unless you have good evidence for it. His mentor, who passed away a couple years ago, Morris Casey, another British agnostic unbeliever, Casey, his mentor, also puts Mark in 40 A.D. But you ready? He uses totally different arguments than James does. In other words, that's a lot of good, strong arguments to take Mark all the way back to the cross. All right, nonetheless, I'll use critical dates. I'll use dates the critics use, because they really don't make, they're not that much later to make a huge difference. So, if that's ground zero, the most common argument for the resurrection is to say, well, if that's 55, here's Mark at about 65 or 70. Again, I'm using critics' dates. Here's Matthew 10 years later at about 80. Here's Luke 5 years later at about 85. And everybody puts John at about 95. So, John's the latest. Subtract 30, John's about 65 years after the cross. Everybody with me? John's about 65 years after the cross. And what evangelical scholars will say is, these are good sources. If you have sources from 40 years after the event to 65 years after the event, that's fair. That's very fair. The best known skeptic in North America is a New Testament scholar by the name of Bart Ehrman. He does have a little connection to England because most of his books are published with Oxford University Press. He's a very well-known scholar, and when he does sources for Jesus, he goes 100 years. So I'm just saying John at 65 is well within the range. I heard of a World War II person who did his memoirs of World War II in the early 1990s. And nobody would say to him, boy, in the 1990s, you're a liar because you're at plus 50. And nobody can remember things 50 years later. You'd say, give the guy a break. Nobody talks like that. Nobody'd say you can't write your memoir of something at plus 50. But at plus 50, we would get every one of the Gospels in except John. And John's only 15 years after that. Now, in comparison, if you compare the New Testament to other ancient books, I'm not picking a bad example here. I'm actually picking a good example. Let's talk about somebody. I mentioned Richard the Lionheart. Let's take Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great dies approximately 300 years before Jesus, so that would be a minus date. He's about 300 years before Jesus, and guess what? A bunch of contemporaries wrote about Alexander, but here's the problem. We don't have any of them. We don't have the histories. They may show up in a monastery someday, but we don't have them right now. The earliest source, extended source, I don't mean a little inscription in stone here or, you know, something else. I'm talking about a major source. The earliest major source for Alexander, if that's Alexander's death down there, the earliest source for Alexander's death, sorry, for Alexander's life, would go like this. Did you get my point? The earliest source for Alexander is just short of 300 years after the fact. Plus 300 for Alexander. Now, memoirs of World War II at plus 50 is one thing. Plus 300 is just too long for good history. But you know what, Alexander, the best two sources for Alexander? Plutarch and Arrian. They're the best two sources. Do you know when they were? Plus 4.25 to 450 after Alexander. We probably go from down there up to the where the folks are there in the balcony. 4.25 to 450 for Alexander. So obviously, we don't know anything about what Alexander did, right? No, we just read the history books. We know a lot about Alexander. But we have much earlier sources for Jesus.
Well, that was the beginning of Gary Habermas's talk on the evidence for the resurrection. Watch it in full as part of the online video training course, Confident Christianity. That's what we've been talking about across all of today's show. I'm really excited that we're releasing this brand new curriculum, which you can do at any time of the day or night, whenever it suits you, but which I really hope will help you to engage with the questions around Christianity, the core beliefs, and the evidence that exists for God, for the historicity of the story of Jesus, for issues around science and suffering. I'd love to hear your feedback if you do go ahead and enroll on the course. And once more, you can get a 50% discount till the 5th of October, okay? You've got till the end of the 5th of October to register for the course at premier.org.uk/getconfident for that discount. Wow. Well, that's a little taster. Hope we've whetted your appetite of what you can get from our brand new apologetics course. We'll be back with part three of the show and lots of your feedback. We're making time for a lot of this week. See you soon.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome back to the third and final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable, coming to you via Premier Christian Radio every Saturday evening, and of course via our podcast as well, also all over the world on our YouTube channel. And we've just released the promo for our new Confident Christianity course there, if you want to go and check that out at our YouTube channel. You can find out more from the show, and of course we love your ratings and reviewings of us as well via podcast too. So if you're listening to the show via podcast, that really helps to get the word out. But yes, you can find out more about us at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Just to say, later on this evening here on Premier Christian Radio, Sam Hales will be in conversation on The Profile with Chrissy Chevisut. Now, Chrissy is a transgender Christian and has a new book out called Heaven Come Down, The Story of a Transgender Disciple. So that should be an interesting one. Next week here on Unbelievable, with the release of the new course, I decided to hold on to our abortion debate till next week. And we're going to be debating the Texas so-called heartbeat bill, which outlaws abortion after 6 weeks, and generally the ethics of abortion, with two people. Both are actually Christians. Stephanie Gray is a leading pro-life advocate in the US, along with the Reverend Bromley McLenahan, who's a church leader in the US who advocates for a pro-choice position. I think you'll find that a really interesting discussion next Saturday on Unbelievable, or wherever you listen to your podcast from, on podcast and video. Thanks to everyone who's been getting in touch over the last couple of weeks, because we've had some really interesting ethical debates, haven't we? We've done the vegan debate. We've done the assisted dying debate. Obviously, we've got our abortion debate coming up next week. Also, those debates on things like psychoactive drugs, psychedelics and so on. Lots of interesting feedback to lots of this stuff, and quite lengthy responses too. So I thought, well, we've got a bit of time on today's show. Why don't we make a bit of an extended feedback section for today's show? So thanks to all those who have been in touch. Why don't we go to some of the The feedback, first of all, on assisted dying. This was last week's show. Rabbi Jonathan Romaine and Dr. Mark Pickering joined me. Rabbi Jonathan Romaine in favour of allowing a new bill to go through Parliament that makes provision for assisted dying for those who are terminally ill, euthanasia. Dr. Mark Pickering of Christian Medical Fellowship making the case against that from both an ethical and religious perspective. This was an interesting one from Reese in Australia, who says, thanks for another great episode. I think Dr. Mark Pickering did a fantastic job at presenting and defending his position in a clear, coherent and logical manner. But my main reason for contacting you this time round was to share my own very personal experience of this topic that I think is relevant to your discussion. I'm a doctor myself, and in 2013 was essentially diagnosed with a terminal illness, namely stage 4 melanoma, which had spread to my brain, lungs and other organs at the time of diagnosis. The median survival for people in my situation was only 3 to 4 months. Long story short, I ended up being part of a clinical trial for new immunotherapy drugs, and as a result, I'm still here today. But over many difficult months, issues around assisted suicide were front and centre to me, even though it wasn't legal at that time. A few years after my diagnosis, my experiences prompted me to write a letter to the Victorian Parliament in Australia where they were discussing a bill on assisted suicide. I subsequently added it on my blog site. You can read it there. As you can see, I share many of the views of Mark on the topic, except for me, they haven't just been a hypothetical or philosophical discussion, but rather part of my lived experience. And I think my case exemplifies a lot of the theoretical concerns Mark and others have regarding legalising assisted suicide. I intentionally left any faith-based arguments out of my letter because, as Mark also points out, a lot of the arguments can be made from a secular, non-religious perspective. But I do think the example of Jesus heightens the arguments to a great degree, and in particular, the argument about whether or not anything good can come from suffering. The entire Christian faith is predicated on the premise that the tremendous good can come from tremendous suffering. The horrible pain and suffering Jesus endured on the cross is not only the path by which Christians can be freed from sin, guilt and punishment and enter eternal life, but as Tom Holland constantly argues, it was the key driver for nearly 2,000 years worth of individuals doing tremendous good in the name of Jesus, which holds true whether you believe he rose from the dead or not. So I think we really do need to push back against the idea that pain and suffering, or even the prospect of pain and suffering, need to be avoided at all costs, especially when those costs are high. Thank you very much. What an interesting story. Really appreciate you getting in touch with me, Reese. And evidently, this has been a debate that's gone through in Australia and, of course, has resulted now in there being forms of assisted dying that are possible in Australia. In fact, Rachel Hocking in Brisbane got in touch with me as well after the show to say, really enjoy the podcast. But I'm writing about the recent one on voluntary assisted dying, which I couldn't fully follow. Seemed to be about UK politics and picking apart each other's campaign. I'm from Australia, so as one of your many international listeners. But unfortunately, in this episode, I gain no further insight into the real issues surrounding voluntary assisted dying from a Christian perspective. Here in Queensland, the government have just passed voluntary assisted dying laws. So it's a very relevant issue here. Please could your guests be mindful of us non-UK listeners and address the ethical issues rather than pull each other's UK-centric political campaigns apart. Thank you, Rachel. I'm sorry that you didn't feel you got a full sense of that. I thought a lot of the points, though, and critiques that were being made are pretty universal wherever assisted dying laws may be being brought up or debated around the world. But do appreciate that. I know we have a very international audience for Unbelievable. The other big debate, of course, was our vegan debate, and that was Greg Boyd and Joshua D. Jones who went up against each other. Very good-natured discussion, actually, but Greg Boyd was our vegan. Joshua Jones defending meat from a sort of health and environmental and theological point of view. And I've got lots of interesting tweets on this. Christian Salzillo says, didn't expect to enjoy this one as much as I did. Very compelling conversation between Christian brothers. Scientism said, surely no Christian would knowingly, needlessly cause suffering and death. That's from a Twitter account that seeks to uphold the rights of any sentient life at all. Anthony Bosman says, Greg Boyd promotes a vegetarian diet, Genesis, eschatology, non-violence on Unbelievable. Given his embrace of cosmic conflict, critique of classical theism and annihilation friendliness, he's become my favourite non-Adventist theologian. Says Anthony, who I assume is an Adventist. Jack Dieter tweets, did they say eat everything but that which might make a brother fall. Those whose faith is weak, if animals have so much worth and their suffering is so important to so many people, how does one explain a God that asked for animal sacrifice? Is it okay to slaughter but not eat? And Skydive Phil says, is it my imagination, Skydive Phil is an atheist on Twitter and elsewhere, is it my imagination, or when Christians are on the losing side of history on issues like homosexuality and animal rights, the relevant unbelievable show is almost certainly not going to involve a non-believer? Well, we had a little bit of an interaction on this tweet you sent, Phil. I would say that on a lot of these ethical issues, I tend to bring Christians or people of faith of different perspectives together, because they don't simply cut neatly down often Christian atheist lines, in my view. And I think the first thing you need to establish is, well, is there a point of view, biblical point of view on these issues that you know? And very often, obviously, people have different perspectives on that. That's why I don't feel the need to necessarily cast them as Christian, non-Christian debates. But anyway, thanks for getting in touch. And Derek in Canada emailed in to say, love the podcast. I thought it was a very respectable dialogue between Greg and Joshua. Did a great job discussing the theological and biblical aspects. Some of their discussion on ethics was also very well done. However, early in the podcast, they were both making comments on farming, and it was hard to listen to. Neither one really knew what they were talking about or have any real understanding of the agricultural industry. As a farmer myself, it just left me annoyed. They don't understand that the love and care for animals most farmers I know have, and they're also coming from a place of privilege. It's one thing for people from their social and financial standing to be vegan or eat meats from small local farms. If you have lower income, you simply cannot afford to live that way. Plus, large-scale farming is absolutely needed if we want to tackle world hunger. It's also not nearly as bad for the environment as travel and traffic, as Greg tried to claim. I wish they would have stuck to the aspects they knew about and could discuss coming from a place of knowledge. Thanks, Derek, in Canada. Steve Densham says, another interesting discussion. I'm not a vegetarian, and like Joshua, I don't support extreme industrialized farming practices. But I like how Joshua also pointed out the impact of vegetable-based farming on natural ecosystems and how it can destroy a disproportionate number of smaller animals and their habitats as part of the farming process. I was debating this topic with my vegan brother-in-law and pointed out to him that 75% of birds in their natural habitat die in their first year of life due to predators, weather, starvation, and other adverse conditions, and another 75% will not last a second year. So after 2 years, only 6% of birds will survive, and the 94% that don't will often suffer an inhumane death. The average laying chicken will produce eggs for at least 2 years, some over 7 years, while if properly regulated or in a homestead farm, they live life in a safe environment, being protected and properly cared for. Even if they are used for meat, after their productive laying years are over, they will most likely have lived a much longer life and experienced a death more humane than otherwise anticipated in the wild. I live in a rural area in Canada, and most informed people understand that a stressed animal is not as productive. Drive down any road and you'll see dairy and meat cattle quietly grazing in their field. COVID has prompted many of my neighbours to raise their own backyard chickens that live lives not too dissimilar from their pet dog or cat. Another important point, if we were to stop eating meat, we would not be extending animals' lives, we'll be depriving them of life. Farmers do not breed their animals in order to keep them as pets. If there's no demand for meat, then animals will stop being bred. So we're not talking about saving the animals, we're ultimately stopping these animals from existing at all, and arguably living a life that would be more protected and humane than in the wild. Okay, interesting points there, Steve. Steve out in Avonmore, Ontario, Canada, and a proud Unbelievable supporter. Thank you, Steve. Thanks for supporting the show. Very, very kind of you. And by the way, that gives me cause to say, if you would like to support the show, you can do that from our website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Click on give. We'll even send you an ebook from the show as a thank you. There's also options for supporting us from the US with tax efficient giving via Premier Insight. So links are all available with the podcast if that's the way you're listening. Mark Bell gets in touch and says, near the end of the show, Greg Boyd mentioned that he thought that the violence of killing animals could desensitize us against other forms of violence. I thought of my father. Before he was saved, my father was an avid hunter. When in his mid-30s he became a Christ follower, he almost immediately sold all his guns. Several years later, I asked him why, and he said because he no longer had a desire to kill anything. Now, in his late 70s, and one of the most godly men you might care to meet, my dad eats very little meat. He doesn't identify as a vegetarian, but he normally only eats meat when he's a guest at someone else's home. It's not quite the same as what Greg was arguing for, but I thought the correlation was interesting. Thank you very much, Mark. Interesting to hear about your dad. Dave says, Justin, wanted to say thanks for all the work you do. Find it really engaging and enriching as I navigate my own questions around faith in God. I'd been especially excited to see you tackling the subject of veganism. I find myself much more in line with Greg's viewpoint, and to be honest, I've often been puzzled by the church's common resistance to the subject. This is only my opinion, of course, but I found Joshua's position ignored or swept problems under the rug. Even if he wants to challenge the logic of Greg, that this isn't a position that should lead us to judge one another, he still is forced to contend with a very basic question. If the whole of creation is a part of the covenant promise, and the picture we have is a world where death will be no more, why keep eating meat? It's a better representation of kingdom living to intentionally kill animals for food, or is it a better representation to kill animals for food, or is killing an animal simply not a moral question at all? Joshua's answer, I feel, avoided facing this head on, which is the only reason why much of his argument could work at all. Once you submit his arguments to the question, the true motivation for eating meat gets exposed pretty quickly. It's because people enjoy eating meat. The part of the argument that rests on the health of a meat-based diet had no relevance to the actual moral problem, which Joshua kept sweeping under the rug. I know that it kept being stated that bringing in questions of the natural world was off topic, but that is actually where I think the issue becomes most aware. How we make sense of death in the natural world, how we make sense of the reality of sentience, which, if you've ever owned a dog, should be indisputable, how we make sense of the unique human responsibility towards nature. All of these things play into a discussion of veganism on a theological level. It seems silly to me that so many Christians remain so adverse to even asking this most basic question. If God wanted us to eat meat, why make it so that animals can feel suffering? Doesn't that seem unnecessary and cruel? Says Dave. Let's go to Matt Stenhouse. Says, great show again. I've been following Greg Boyd's work for the past couple of years. Typically, I find Greg's theological and ethical arguments compelling. I understand where he's coming from, and I respect Christians making a conscious decision to adopt a vegan diet. However, if the resurrected Jesus ate a fish, I don't see there being a theological argument as to why I should not. That being said, there must also be something to why I can't see myself ever eating a dolphin. This debate did remind me of the time you were discussing Greg's cruciform hermeneutic with Tom Wright. As I recall, Tom was uncomfortable with Greg's approach, but I don't think he ever explained why. I know Greg has great respect for Tom Wright. I recently read The Day the Revolution Began on Greg's advice. If anyone would be able to bring the two men together for a conversation, it'd be you, Justin. Would love to hear such a conversation from two people willing to ask and answer tough questions with great wisdom. Thank you very much, Matt. Maybe see what I can do on that front. This one from David Drosek says, big fan of your programs, Justin, unbelievable, and Ask NT Wright Anything. Especially appreciate seeing the British perspective on faith and religion. If you ever revisit the veganism topic, an interesting angle would be to look specifically at plant-based whole foods and the science about the health benefits. Someone from the Seventh-day Adventist denomination who's also affiliated with the lifestyle medicine movement would be great. Thank you very much, Dave. And now we come to a very lengthy email here, and I'll give you the background to this one. I have known back in childhood three friends, brothers and sisters, who were Antonia, Conrad, and Zoe, but probably haven't been in touch directly with any of them for getting on for 30 years or so, really since you know, early teens. It was a delight to be contacted by Antonia, one of those friends, I guess a few months ago. I think it was through Instagram, if I remember rightly. We found each other again, and Antonia is now a doula, a birth assistant, but also very active when it comes to the ecology, climate change, and environmental activism, and indeed a very committed vegan. So Antonia, who had started listening to some episodes of Unbelievable since we reconnected on Instagram, was very interested in this upcoming debate and has given me, as I say, a very lengthy response to this. But I have promised Antonia I'll try and read as much of it as I can in response to that vegan show. So Antonia, this is for you and for all the listeners who will be interested in what you have to say on this. On my last dog walk, I tuned into your latest episode about veganism. I've been vegan for years and I consider this way of living to be a massive privilege. I have the time and money to buy organic fruit, veg and grains, and I adore cooking for my family from scratch. Lots of people lack the time and money to be able to eat this way, and many don't have the cooking skills, which have stopped being passed down through the generations. Huge sections of British society don't even have cooking facilities to begin with, since so many people are living under the poverty line. I'm hugely aware of how fortunate I am. So rather than insisting everyone goes vegan, my take on this is that if you're in a position to cause less harm, then you absolutely should. I listened with interest to the episode on veganism, but at the end, I felt disappointed. Felt like so many vital points were left out of the discussion. Climate change threatens our very existence, and what we eat has a huge impact. This was massively downplayed by your guest, Joshua. Now, I know that there's nothing worse than a vegan spouting facts, but as so many were missed out, I feel compelled. Please humour me. I wonder if you knew that 60% of biodiversity loss is caused by animal agriculture, or that, according to researchers from Oxford, meat, dairy, egg and fish farming use 83% of the world's farmland, yet provide only 18% of the world's calories, or that 70 billion farm animals are being raised for food annually. There are only 7.8 billion of us. Madness when you compare the numbers. Joshua's point about rabbits and mice dying because of crops is, of course, true. This happened. But what he didn't mention is that the majority of those monocrops are grown to feed animals that are then eaten by humans. Over 75% of global soybean crops are fed to animals, not vegans. Farming animals is such a fantastically inefficient way to feed the current human population. Animal agriculture uses vast amounts of land and water resources, which at this point in time is inexcusable. And now things are so bad, we've raped the land so much that animals are being fed fish. We're now emptying the oceans of fish to feed all the vegetarian cows and sheep. It's absolute madness, says Antonia. The world's 7.8 billion people represent just 0.01% of all living things, but humanity has caused the loss of 83% of all wild animals and half of plants while raising animals for meat in ever-increasing numbers. There's no way Joshua could have even begun to defend this, but all the people listening to the podcast were done a disservice by not being given the full facts. Whilst grass-fed animals are seen by some, including Joshua, as the solution, that is a rich man's game and an option not available to most consumers. Joshua himself even mentioned that healthy food is not available to huge swathes of society, which is true. Food deserts are everywhere, and so grass-fed is simply unrealistic. And whilst this method of farming may be nicer for the animals, it's an environmental disaster because of all the land and water it requires. Whilst there's a lot to be said for regenerative farming, there's absolutely no need to make the animals who could roam the land part of the food chain. Swimming around in regenerative farming conversations is the false idea that we need manure to compost the ground. We don't. There are numerous other ways to offer the soil nutrients. The answer here is rewilding. Nature knows what to do. If we stopped eating animals, we'd be able to rewind up to one third of all the Earth's surface, which would draw down enough carbon to reverse climate breakdown. The frustration inside this truth is agonizing. You go on to talk about the ethics of killing animals, saying, have you ever visited a slaughterhouse? I'm sure you would compare it quite realistically to the hell that the Bible talks about. As Paul McCartney said, if slaughterhouses had glass walls, everyone would be vegetarian. Joshua himself said he was no expert on carbon emissions, evident in the 3% stat he stated, which was incorrect. The real number is much higher, and preferred to stick to the teachings on the Bible on this. As I'm sure you'll agree, that is ludicrous considering when the Bible was written. Factory farms didn't exist 2,000 years ago, so we can't lean on the Bible for guidance here. Animals farmed for their flesh, or livestock, as meat eaters call them, produce 130 times more waste than humans, which, when you think about the methane and the devastation of our water systems, is again horrendous. The conversation moved on to biblical perspectives. Many of your guests, including Joshua and Greg, seem to take the Bible literally, so it was a surprise that Joshua didn't mention that after God tells Adam and Eve that they live on vegetables and fruits, or that it was Jesus himself who seemed to call for an end to animal sacrifice. In the Gospels, part of the business being done in front of the temple was to sell animals for sacrifice in the temple, and it's made clear that Jesus didn't approve. And where does thou shalt not kill come in? You yourself mentioned Jesus wasn't a vegan, but I'm sure you and I can both agree that he emanated love and compassion, which makes me wonder what he would make of factory farming. Later on, Joshua claimed that eating animals was the right thing to do, to save them being eaten by other animals in the wild. I was on the edge of my seat waiting for sweet Greg to jump in, but he didn't. As I mentioned before, we kill over 70 billion animals a year. Can you even imagine that number? We're completely overrun with cows and pigs and sheep and chickens because we breed them into existence at a rate of knots to feed our insatiable desire for flesh. If we stopped breeding them, then they wouldn't have to live in the wild. They wouldn't exist. Come on, Joshua. Alex O'Connor does a much better job of arguing this point than I do in one of his amazing talks on veganism. At one point, you said that eating meat is natural and part of a balanced diet, which is absolutely what I used to believe. I would urge you to watch What the Health on Netflix and do some further research. You won't regret it. You go on to make notes about B12 and supplements and so on. And you say, actually, all plants contain protein. There really aren't issues in the level that, that are sometimes pointed out in that degree. Greg mentioned Dominion by Matthew Scully. Animals are more than ever a test of our character, of mankind's capacity for empathy and for decent, honourable conduct and faithful stewardship. We are called to treat them with kindness, not because they have rights or some claim to equality, but in a sense because they don't, because they stand unequal and powerless before us. I wonder how you feel about this. Lots more in this letter from you, but I'm going to sort of scroll on a little bit further to the end to say there's so much to consider. I feel really sad that so much was left out of the conversation. 90 minutes is more than enough time to cover the main points. Ethics aside, I am bereft that the environmental impact of eating animals are not bothering the Christian community as much as they should. And I'm reminded of a mentor I once had who told me that her faith enabled her to not really care about the planet because she was going to heaven. So what did it matter? I'll never forget how I felt when she said that. I was too stunned to respond, but I often think about it and it takes my breath away every time. Justin, I know you believe in heaven, so I'm wondering if you share her view. Maybe you aren't too worried about this planet we live in, or if you feel that it's a mere stepping stone, a motel, if you like, on the road towards the main destination. I myself share Dave Tomlinson's view that since God is in every single part of this stunning world and all that lives and breathes within it, the human destruction of the natural world is akin to a second crucifixion. We're literally killing God all over again. The sorrow is immeasurable. I'd appreciate you taking the time to read this and would welcome your thoughts. Well, Antonio, I have responded, as you know, if you're listening to your email. And I do appreciate all the points you've made in it. As to your final question, do I consider that Earth is just a stepping stone, you know, and we'll go off to heaven and we don't need to worry about it? Well, no, that is not what I believe. And I would encourage you to maybe listen to my other podcast, the Ask NT Write Anything podcast, where we do deal with these kinds of issues. Because I do believe that what we're promised is a renewed heaven and earth, the coming together of those two things. And part of what it means to live in the now and not yet of that kingdom coming is to look after the planet God has given us. He entrusted us, you know, to be good stewards of this good creation he made. And that absolutely involves us acting responsibly and ethically towards the environment and towards the creatures that he has put in our care. So obviously how that works out will be different for different people. I will say I'm not a vegan or a vegetarian at this point. I'm always willing to be convinced, though. That's you know, I hope I've always got an open mind to anyone who wants to persuade me on that front. Great to hear from you. Thank you so much, and for your email. It's good to make your just connect, make the connection again with you as well, and Antonia, in the last few months. For now, that's all we've time for here on Unbelievable. Thank you so much for being with us. Again, just before we finish up today's show, just a final reminder that our Confident Christianity course has been released. You can get it with 50% off if you go to our website, premier.org.uk/getconfident. That's just until the 5th of October, though, and you'll get access to the whole course with all of that video teaching, questions and learning activities on it. So do go and check that out. Again, premier.org.uk/getconfident. Right now, let me tell you what's coming up next time. Well, we put this on hold until next week, but we'll be bringing you our abortion debate. The Texas heartbeat bill has been allowing abortion now, has been outlawing abortion after 6 weeks. Well, joining me to debate that are Stephanie Gray, a leading pro-life advocate in the US, and the Reverend Bromley McClenahan, a church leader in the USA who advocates for a pro-choice position. That's on next week's show. Until then, have a good week.